This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Welcome to the Investor Download, the podcast about the themes driving markets and the economy now and in the future. I'm your host, David Brett. And on today's show, this is the story of Bitcoin. What are investors' concerns?
You know, the insurance mechanisms, the recourse mechanisms are all much weaker than they would be for, you know, money stored in a bank account with a conventional bank.
The reasons why the big investors have yet to fully embrace Bitcoin.
I think the reticence of the institutional investor community to embrace crypto assets is really a bit of a chicken and egg problem.
And ultimately, what's the real value of Bitcoin?
With Bitcoin, we don't really have that luxury. The fair price could well be zero. It may well be the case that there will never be any intrinsic or fundamental or real value.
It's been just over a decade since Bitcoin was introduced to the world. Yet the idea of digital currency is nothing new.
So that I think that the internet is going to be one of the major forces for reducing the role of government. The one thing that's missing, but that will soon be developed, is a reliable e-cash, a method whereby on the internet you can transfer funds from A to B without A knowing B or B knowing A.
That was economist Milton Friedman back in the 90s. Yet, nearly 30 years on, we're only just beginning to come to terms with the technology and how it might be used in the future. In this show, Ben Popatlau, a strategist in the multi-asset team, joins me to discuss where the future of Bitcoin and other digital currencies lie and why fund managers and other big institutions have so far been reluctant to get involved. But first, we're going to take a brief look at the history of Bitcoin.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
Let's start with the story of Bitcoin. It exists as strings of computer code with no physical form and was developed by a secretive software developer using the name Satoshi Nakamoto.
One of the biggest mysteries in the technology world is the identity of Satoshi Nakamoto, the computer programmer who invented the digital currency Bitcoin. That's because Satoshi Nakamoto is a pseudonym. It may be the name of one person or the name of a group.
Bitcoin first came into existence at the start of 2009, but a tradable price for Bitcoin, the asset, only really became established in 2010. There's obviously the famous story about two people online organizing a transaction for, you know, two pizzas.
I just told people I wanted a pizza and I want to pay with Bitcoin. I didn't want a gift card. I didn't want some weird exchange. I wanted to give you Bitcoin and you give me pizza.
10,000 Bitcoins. I think that would be about $320 million now for those two pizzas. And then an exchange called Mt. Gox was launched, which was the first public exchange for Bitcoin. And it was there that you could kind of buy, sell, and store your Bitcoin. So it was from there that that a market for the asset, the native asset on the blockchain, on the Bitcoin blockchain, really began. In terms of, you know, at the time, vendors or merchants that were accepting Bitcoin in terms of, you know, as a transaction, as a means of transaction, many of them were illicit. Many of them were kind of underground online merchants, and that's what's probably given Bitcoin some of its, its character today, or its kind of reputation today. But, you know, as time has gone on, and, you know, Mt. Gox itself failed.
It's absolutely terrible for people who use Mt. Gox. And, you know, I think there's a real risk that some people will never see their money again there.
And as time has gone on, some more kind of above board merchants have been accepting Bitcoin, and the momentum has continued from there.
While intended to be used as an alternative currency to pay for goods and services, its main use so far has been speculative trading. Its value almost quadrupled last year, chased higher by retail investors enticed by its exponential rise and institutional investors seeking a potential hedge against inflation. But to understand what Bitcoin is, we first have to understand the technology behind it, blockchain.
Blockchain technology is a form of decentralized and distributed record keeping with respect to transactions.
The record keeping is like a ledger. A block is like a page on that ledger. And each time a block is completed, it gives way to the next block in the blockchain. The ledger itself is not owned by one person or organization. It's owned by a community, which is basically computers. And that community, by majority, decides whether a transaction is valid or not. Essentially, the community plays the role of the banker, bringing the two parties together, then metaphorically rubber stamping their transaction. But why would random people get together to ratify a transaction that's got nothing to do with them?
Well, because they're incentivized to do so. And they're incentivized by the code that is built into this blockchain technology that says that if you successfully verify a block of transactions on the network, then you'll be rewarded with an asset, a digital asset. And that digital asset in this case is the Bitcoin.
But to get the incentive, you need to show your proof of work, you know, a bit like you had to do in a maths exam. In this case, proof of work requires the people or computers to solve a complex mathematical problem to be able to add a block to the chain. The mathematical problem can only be solved by trial and error. And the odds of solving the problem, well, they're about 1 in 5.9 trillion.
And so, again, they have to contribute a lot of their computing power. And over the years, that is a lot. It's relatively energy intensive.
According to reports back in 2019, Bitcoin's energy consumption equaled that of Switzerland.
Now, it's not really a kind of a hobby anymore for the normal person because the hardware involved is quite extreme. But these computers are called miners, miners in the same way that you would be mining gold. And as these computers verify transactions, they are given a reward in the form of Bitcoin, and that is newly minted Bitcoin,
which as at the time of recording is worth somewhere around $48,000 per Bitcoin. But if you're interested in becoming a miner, then you better be quick.
From the start up until now, a vast majority of the Bitcoin has already been minted, because early on in the life of Bitcoin, the reward for verifying a transaction was a lot higher. It was 50 Bitcoin at one point. Now it's about 6.25 Bitcoin. The blockchain code also stipulates that over time, the reward for verifying a set of transactions on the network will decrease. So every 4 years, the amount of Bitcoins that you get for verifying a transaction will cut in half, basically. So you can imagine that in 100 years or so, the reward for verifying a set of transactions will be extremely low. And then what that does is it mathematically or mechanically caps the number of Bitcoin that can ever be in existence at around 21 million.
But would that limit ever be increased?
Well, the cap is mechanically engineered into the blockchain code. So there would have to be some consensus in the community in order to change the rules that govern the supply of Bitcoin. So really, in theory, yes, it is possible to change the supply schedule, but in practice, it's probably more difficult to change the supply schedule of Bitcoin than it is to change the supply schedule of the US dollar, for example.
So it appears, for the time being at least, there's an upper limit on the amount of Bitcoin that will ever be available, which is why some people have likened it to a commodity, such as gold. And despite being a virtual asset, like gold, owners of Bitcoin need somewhere to store such a valuable commodity.
The normal investor buying Bitcoin online, you buy the actual Bitcoin on an exchange or platform such as Coinbase. You then store your Bitcoin either in a digital wallet, so that could be online storage, or it can be offline storage on a hard drive that's not connected to the internet. So again, it's this trade-off between accessibility and security,
which is where some of the fun can begin.
We have seen some horror stories in the news about people losing their Bitcoin.
We've all forgotten a password or two online, but that mistake doesn't usually cost us $200 million. But that's exactly what's happening with Stefan Thomas, a programmer from Germany, now living in California. In 2011, Stefan won 7,000 Bitcoin for making this video about how cryptocurrency works. Back then, each Bitcoin was worth about $5. He stashed them away in a digital wallet. Now the contents of that wallet are worth more than $200 million. But Stefan doesn't know the passcode to get in.
When did the penny drop that actually what you'd thrown away was worth a fortune?
When I started to hear stories of, you know, the Silk Road shut down, and obviously other individuals making their profits and their millions, the penny dropped then, you know, that I had 7,500 bitcoins on a hard drive that I'd thrown out a few months ago.
So according to a recent study by Chainalysis, about 4 million bitcoins have been lost and cannot be recovered, leaving those owners of the Bitcoin who can't access their investments out of pocket with little hope of compensation.
I think the concern generally is that Bitcoin being less of an established form of either currency or asset, the insurance mechanisms, the recourse mechanisms are all much weaker than they would be for, you know, money stored in a bank account with a conventional bank.
Thankfully, most investors in Bitcoin don't have to worry about that. The majority, including big institutions, use more complex financial instruments to buy Bitcoin, such as derivatives.
Derivatives, as the name suggests, derive their price from the underlying asset. So you don't actually buy the Bitcoin itself, rather you buy a contract that derives its value from the underlying asset, which is Bitcoin.
You pay a small fraction of the price of the underlying asset for the derivative contract, which, whether it be an option or a future, gives you the right to purchase or sell the underlying asset on a specified future date. Although, a word of warning, derivatives are highly risky.
We are also seeing the rise of exchange-traded vehicles, which may well hold the Bitcoin in its, again, physical form. But those ETFs are, at the moment, it's concentrated in a couple or even one vehicle at the moment.
So we know how Bitcoin is created, roughly what it's worth, how you go about buying it, and the risks involved in keeping it safe. But what about demand for Bitcoin? Why? When individual investors are climbing the walls trying to invest in Bitcoin, have the big investors been so reluctant to jump on board? Stay tuned for part two.
Get in touch with us by email at schroederspodcasts@schroeders.com or visit our website, schroeders.com/investor download.
Fund manager BlackRock recently announced it's allowed Bitcoin in two of its funds for the first time. It's the first among the big asset managers to do so, which is a pretty big deal for the asset and the asset manager themselves.
Yeah, so BlackRock is certainly not the first to announce its involvement with Bitcoin, but it is definitely the largest, being the largest asset manager in the world. Up until now, I think most institutional money flowing into this asset class would either have been through specialist vehicles such as hedge funds that can restrict investment to qualified investors, or perhaps asset owners that are buying Bitcoin directly and so are kind of only accountable to themselves. So a large, well-known mainstream asset manager like BlackRock making such an announcement is quite a big deal.
Yet few so far, and certainly anywhere near the size of BlackRock, have followed suit.
I think the reticence of the institutional investor community to embrace crypto assets is really a bit of a chicken and egg problem. Institutional investors are waiting for crypto assets to mature, but it is the process of organizations like ours and like BlackRock opening our arms to this new asset class that will lead to the professionalization of the market. So as more and more pieces of the puzzle fit into place, things like clarity around regulation, efficient access and liquidity, security assurances, the emergence of enduring use cases, I think we can expect greater institutional involvement in the asset class going forward.
Regulation of cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin is certainly on policymakers' radar. Janet Yellen, head of the US Treasury, and Christine Lagarde, president of the European Central Bank, are among many that have called for more regulation.
Yes, the direction of travel is certainly for more regulation, and so that, I think that's what we should expect. All of the key major regulators on a global stage have at least talked about Bitcoin and the possibility of regulating it more. So we certainly should expect more regulation. But, you know, Bitcoin and crypto assets in general, and certainly blockchain technology, is difficult to regulate directly due to their kind of decentralized nature. So rather than regulating Bitcoin itself or the blockchain technology underlying Bitcoin, I think that the practical means by which regulators will try to gain some control over the asset class is through regulating the exchanges where you buy and sell and store your Bitcoin. So, but actually, you know, given that the world, I think, is used to regulation, and certainly in a financial industry, we are used to regulation, actually the arrival of regulators on the scene providing some structure around the way that Bitcoin works and the way that it operates could actually be positive for the professionalisation of the asset class.
Which would be a big step for the asset class in its role as part of a wider investment portfolio in the future. And that's what we'll be discussing in the final part of the show. Bitcoin has been labelled a con, a pyramid scheme, and a bubble in the manner of Dutch tulips. Its price continues to fluctuate wildly. In Britain, the Financial Conduct Authority said this month that investors in digital currencies should be prepared to lose everything. So, with such uncertainty, how do you put a value on Bitcoin?
Yeah, so that's the ultimate question, I suppose. You know, with other asset classes, with established asset classes, we can take for granted that there is some value in the asset class. You know, we can take for granted that there is a fair price somewhere and that the fair price is probably not zero. And so then the investment problem is, to what extent does the market price reflect the fair price? You know, that's the normal investment problem, if you like. With Bitcoin, we don't really have that luxury. The fair price could well be zero. It may well be the case that there will never be any intrinsic or fundamental or real value to Bitcoin now or in the future. So first and foremost, we need to establish whether or not there's any chance of there ever being intrinsic value in this asset class. And we think that intrinsic value rests on utility value. So utility value means, you know, what role could, or what role does, or what role could Bitcoin play in the world? What meaning could it have? What use cases could it possibly have? And we think that there are three potential categories of utility value. These are as a store of wealth, as a medium of transaction, and for use in digital contracts.
Digital contracts, or smart contracts, reflect the programmable nature of digital money, which means you can set logical rules governing how the money should be used.
And so you can imagine this use case in things like insurance contracts, you know, only pay out if X happens, trust money contracts, business-to-business transactions, business-to-business lending, things like that. So digital contracts have quite an exciting use case potential going forward. And our research shows that we think that Bitcoin can stack up against the incumbent asset classes as a store of wealth, but it can't really stack up as a medium of exchange, at least at this stage.
However, recent developments hint that things might be starting to change. America's oldest bank, Bank of New York Mellon, said it will soon start storing and issuing cryptocurrencies for clients.
We have some news just out, back to the Bitcoin topic. It's like you can't get away from it. A big bank is now adopting crypto. Bank of New York Mellon will hold and transfer and issue Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies on behalf of its asset management clients. Now, the bank planned to eventually treat digital currencies, it says, like any other asset. So,
Tesla, the car maker,
Yeah, of course. Well, we got to talk about the big news of the day, which is obviously Tesla buying $1.5 billion worth of Bitcoin and also saying that it would accept Bitcoin as payment for some of its vehicles, which is kind of interesting.
And social media firm Twitter both announced they were investigating the possibilities of accepting and using Bitcoin, among other cryptocurrencies, in transactions. If that were to happen, then it ticks another utility value box in terms of giving Bitcoin a medium of exchange. Until then, its value is speculative, but some have compared it to gold, given its finite supply and relative rarity.
We're not convinced by the analogy to or the nickname digital gold. We see Bitcoin more as a digital collectible, akin to more obscure parts of the alternative investment world, at least for now. Bitcoin is quite a long way from earning its stripes as a safe haven, the way that gold has over thousands of years. It might appear structurally a hedge for inflation because of its deflationary supply schedule. What I mean by that is generally the supply of fiat currencies such as the US dollar or the pound has increased over time, whereas Bitcoin is mechanically set to decrease over time. But again, Bitcoin's price behavior hasn't really stood the test of time the way that other safe haven assets like gold have, or indeed the US dollar and other major currencies.
So it's fair to say that right now it's difficult to put a fair value on Bitcoin.
Well, I mean, in terms of actually valuing Bitcoin identifying a fair price, if indeed there is one, generally so far we've drawn upon the existing work in the industry. So, for example, we can look at the size of the existing market for Bitcoin's potential use cases that I just mentioned and look at the assets that are currently servicing those use cases. So, for example, gold is being used as a store of wealth and cash is being used in transactions. And then we can make some kind of forecast about how much of that market share we think Bitcoin could grab in the future. And I think many of the other asset managers and the investment banks and commentators out there are doing exactly that. They're assuming that Bitcoin will grab a certain amount of market share from gold as a store of wealth, and then they're projecting that into the future. When estimating the share of global transactions that Bitcoin could take, could grab in the future, you need to make quite a lot of assumptions about the velocity of money, the number of times that each Bitcoin will go through a number of transactions in a given year, for example. So there are lots of assumptions you need to make, but that is one fairly basic step towards trying to work out a potential future price for Bitcoin. There are models that measure scarcity in the same vein as you would measure the scarcity of gold. And these try to estimate a fair value given the amount of Bitcoin currently in existence versus how much is being created each year. So again, you can think of the analogy to gold in that sense, how much gold is already above ground and how much gold is being mined in a given year. And from that, again, you could try to work out a potential value for the Bitcoin that is already in existence. And there are lots more models out there that are being used. I would call them probably quasi-fundamental models as opposed to fundamental models that attempt to measure the fair price of Bitcoin. All of these models, I would caution, are controversial. They're up for debate. They haven't stood the test of time. They haven't got lots of data going into them. And they are models that we are observing rather than actually using.
So, given the difficulty at the moment of putting a fair value on Bitcoin, would it be fair to expect more price volatility in the near term?
I think the volatility of Bitcoin for now is inevitable. I think as the investment community, from retail investors through to institutional investors and also regulators and central banks, as everybody gets their head around what Bitcoin means for the future, so it is quite difficult for institutional investors to include an asset like Bitcoin just simply because of its high volatility and the uncertainty around that volatility. So, institutional investors have generally sat on the sidelines during Bitcoin's 10-year rookie season, if you like, as an investable asset.
But what does the future hold for Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies?
I think, as well as talk of increased regulation, there is a lot of talk around central banks creating their own digital currencies. Personally, I don't think that central bank digital currencies necessarily need to compete with currencies like Bitcoin. Again, there's also talk of things like stable coins. I'm less positive on stable coins. I think that they will compete with central bank digital currencies. You know, stable coins effectively peg their value to existing fiat currencies like the US dollar, but they have to fully back those currencies with reserves in their own bank accounts in order to be able to peg their value to the dollar. That seems potentially redundant if central banks launch their own digital currencies. But Bitcoin and the blockchain technology that underlies it is certainly much more flexible than that. It's not just a currency. You know, we've seen platforms like Ethereum or the Ethereum blockchain, which has its own native asset called the Ether, launching a blockchain that's much more flexible for other use cases than is the Bitcoin blockchain. So for example, you can launch applications on the Ethereum blockchain as opposed to just using it as a ledger of transaction. So there's a lot going on in the world of cryptography, if you like, and the blockchain technology world beyond just the crypto assets that are associated with them. But again, yeah, the future of Bitcoin itself will very much depend on the regulatory environment, the emergence of enduring use cases. So for us, that means as a store of value and in things like digital contracts. And again, as I said, potential competition from central bank digital currencies. But it will be interesting to see how those things play out.
Here's what else investors are talking about. Despite the frenzy surrounding GameStop, Chief Investment Officer Johanna Kirkland believes retail investor share ownership should be encouraged, but not in wildly inflated stocks. And while there are concerns of a stock market bubble, Johanna says there are reasons to accept some risk. And you can find out more by reading Johanna's article, Why I Can Stomach Higher Equity Valuations, as well as others at schroders.com/insights. Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to find out more, you can go to schroders.com/the investor download. There you can listen to our back catalogue and read related articles. If you want to contact us about anything in the show, email us at schroderspodcast@schroders.com. You can rate, review and subscribe to us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New shows are available every Thursday and every Monday from 5 p.m. UK time. But above all, keep safe. And go well. Cheers.